From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The second half of the long NBA season has begun. We'll look at who's poised for greatness and who's just hoping for a high lottery pick. Also, Canadians call for the return of NHL teams to the frozen north and forget golf carts. We'll talk to a guy who walked from golf course to golf course and saw an entire country along the way. Also ahead, whether it's called a tower climb or a run-up, there's one race athletes who enjoy stairs aspire to complete.
This is like the Wimbledon of stair racing. This is where it's at. If you're a thoroughbred, you want to be at the Kentucky Derby. If you're a NASCAR racer, you want to be at Indianapolis. If you're a stair racer, you want to be at the Empire State Building.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Pacers are way off the pace. The Wizards have no magic. The howling of the Timberwolves has reached the point of tragic. There's lasting hope for next to last in Oklahoma City, and who can bear the Grizzlies, for their play has not been pretty. Joining me now to discuss some of the NBA teams at the top rather than at the bottom of their respective divisions is Kevin Hanch of Fox Sports. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
The Boston Celtics and the Cleveland Cavaliers are competing for the best record in the NBA's Eastern Conference. What do you think? Will LeBron James lead the Cavs to home court advantage throughout the playoffs, or will Boston prevail again?
As I said back in the fall, Bill, when we first spoke this season, I said LeBron and Kobe would meet in the finals in a dream matchup, and I think part of that is going to be the Cavaliers securing home court in the Eastern Conference.
Kevin Garnett departed early from the Celtics' loss to Utah on Thursday night after injuring his knee. How well can the Celtics hold up if Garnett ends up missing any significant time?
Well, they can tread water for a little while without Garnett, but he's obviously the heart and soul of that team. I think they'll really suffer defensively without him, and that's a big part of the reason. You know, whether he's out for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month, that, I think, will be the difference in home court advantage vis the Cavaliers, because he is the engine that makes that team go.
The Orlando Magic have a solid lead in the Southeast Division. Center Dwight Superman Howard is having a terrific season, but is his supporting cast strong enough so that that team can make a deep playoff run, or does he need better sidekicks?
I think losing Jameer Nelson was a crushing blow for the Magic. I know they picked up Rafer Alston, but I think that's not a fair trade. I mean, Jameer Nelson is such a tough player, such a good defender, such a clutch shooter, and Rafer Alston, I just don't think at the point can provide what Jameer Nelson did. So I think they'll win one round and then depart in the second round.
After the Celtics, Cavaliers, and Magic, there is a pretty noticeable drop-off in the Eastern Conference. But what do you think? Are there any teams poised for postseason success below those three?
Well, I still think the Atlanta Hawks are a team nobody really wants to play. As they proved last year, taking the Celtics to seven games, they've got a lot of talent. I think that series will help them this year, and I could definitely see them led by Joe Johnson and Mike Bibby upsetting someone in the second round.
In the Western Conference, the Lakers are leading the race for the top playoff spot, as they did last year. Center Andrew Bynum is hurt, as he was last year, and Kobe Bryant is scoring a lot of points, as he did last year. So, the Lakers headed back to the finals, you think?
Absolutely. In fact, I can't believe how far they've separated from the Western Conference. The Western Conference used to be this murderer's row of contenders, and now it's sort of the Lakers and a bunch of pretenders. The Spurs have gotten old in a hurry, and I know Manu Ginobili is about to miss another 3 weeks. The Hornets can't even trade Tyson Chandler because of his toe injury. It's really Chris Paul and David West and a bunch of direct. And meanwhile, the Lakers, even though they lost to Andrew Bynum, they've been firing on all cylinders, and Lamar Odom has been resurrected. He has answered the bell lately. He has put up some huge numbers. He's been an animal, and I feel like the Lakers are a team on a mission. Kobe's on a mission. I don't think they'll lose four games total in the Western Conference playoffs before they get to the finals. Forget someone beating them four times in one series. You heard it here.
Well, this is the kind of tape that we're inclined to save.
All right.
Okay. The Denver Nuggets, leading the Northwest Division. In the Central, the Detroit Pistons have lost five straight and are just a game over 500. Earlier this season, the two teams swapped star guards, with Allen Iverson going to Detroit, Chauncey Billups moving to Denver. Which team eventually benefits from that deal?
Well, I think Denver definitely has benefited in the short term. Chauncey Billups has turned that team around, and they're playing very well. I don't think it really matters that much, because I don't think either of those teams is a true contender. But Billups has definitely made Denver better than Iverson has made the Pistons.
The Phoenix Suns fired their head coach, Terry Porter, this week. Interim coach Alvin Gentry says that he'll trade Porter's defensive game plans for a fast break style that made the Suns successful in the past. If the playoffs began today, the Suns wouldn't make the cut. So does the coaching change give them a shot?
Well, if Alvin Gentry could play the L.A. Clippers every game, he would win Coach of the Year.
That could be said of a lot of coaches.
The Suns put up 280 points in about 24 hours on the Clippers. But I think the Suns, you know, with the news that Amari Stoudemire is going to be out for quite a while now with the retina problem, I think the Suns will fade in the West. That's a big rebuilding project for Steve Kerr.
The Houston Rockets guard Tracy McGrady announced this week that he has decided to have season-ending microfracture surgery on his knee, which sounds awful. I don't know exactly what it means. McGrady has only played more than 70 regular season games twice since 2003. What does his latest injury mean for the Rockets, and what does it mean for him?
Well, it definitely signaled the end of the Rockets season, and they confirmed that by trading Rafer Alston, basically waving the white flag on this season, and they're going to look to the future with Kyle Lowry at the point. Houston Rockets were my big sleeper team this year. I really thought the addition of Artest would make them tougher with Yao Ming, Tracy McGrady, Shane Battier. I just thought that team had so many parts that would make it so tough in the playoffs, but McGrady's injury sort of wipes all that out, and you know, now they're just another one-and-done team in the Western Conference.
Kevin, I was going to ask you about some of the other teams in the West, but you have pretty much dismissed their chances. I'm going to give you one more chance. Does anybody among the Trailblazers, the Hornets, the Spurs, whom you dismissed, any of them have a shot at catching the Lakers?
They certainly don't have a chance at catching the Lakers, and barring another injury to the Lakers, I don't think any of them have a chance to beat them in a seven-game series, although I do like the Trailblazers' trajectory. I think that is a team that in the next year or two we can look for to maybe be the heir apparent to the Lakers in the West.
All right, all there is left to ask you about is, I guess, who gets to four games first in the finals and how many games the runner-up ends up winning.
The Lakers are going to win that championship. They will not get the revenge that they want against the hated Celtics, because they're going to beat LeBron's Cleveland Cavaliers in six games.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA for Fox Sports and fearlessly predicts things like that for us every once in a while. Kevin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Back in the early 90s, the National Hockey League began charting a course into places where there is no ice outside of highball glasses. Some of these expansion teams, like the San Jose Sharks, are doing very well, but others are losing money and playing in half-empty arenas. Some people, especially those north of the border in Canada, see that as a sign that the NHL should end its great sunshine experiment altogether. Only a Game's Dave Naylor reports.
It's a Friday night in late January, and the man on this Tampa Bay street corner is getting the cold shoulder from everyone he approaches. He's not a panhandler, he's a ticket scalper. But he's not getting any action, even though he's peddling tickets at well below face value for a game between the Tampa Lightning and Philadelphia Flyers.
Ticket market here is terrible. Never seen anything so bad in my life for NHL hockey.
Can you get face value?
No, not today. Maybe some games here, but not for this one. Seems like everybody from out of town that's in town, you'd be able to get face value, but you're not able to.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm losing a few hundred dollars.
Ticket scalpers aren't the only ones losing money on hockey in the southern United States. So too are owners. While the NHL has done well in cities such as Dallas and San Jose, most of the Sun Belt teams play in arenas that are often little more than half full, like this one in Tampa for the Flyers game. In Sunrise, Florida, the Panthers are including free giveaways for food and gas with $17 tickets. And in Nashville, the team says it's considering buying its own tickets to pad attendance in order to qualify for league revenue sharing. Worst of all is Phoenix, where the NHL has been advancing money to the Coyotes just to keep the team afloat, a team that's expected to lose well in excess of $30 million this season, and where hockey fans appear scarce.
And money selling tickets? Okay, selling?
Compare that to the situation in Toronto, where ticket scalpers are on the job at noon most game days, and where just getting yourself into the building will cost you more than it does to take a whole family to see a game in most of the NHL's Sunbelt cities.
What do you got? What are your range?
125 to 500 each.
What's a good night?
200 to get in is a good night.
Not surprisingly, a lot of people are asking why the NHL insists on keeping teams in places where sports fans don't seem all that interested in hockey. Bob McCowan is the host of Canada's primetime sports radio show and an outspoken critic of the NHL's Sunbelt strategy.
What we've known in the United States is that Americans are very familiar with hockey. They understand hockey. They've seen hockey. What we understand is they don't like hockey. And that's really the story that the National Hockey League refuses to accept and understand. You know, they stick their head in the sand, play ostrich, and hope this story will go away, but it's the truth. I mean, and if you look at the franchises in the NHL that are in peril right now, the commonality is geography. They're all in the southern half of the United States.
Here in Toronto, hockey fans are well aware that they pay high prices to see NHL hockey, and that some of that money is going directly south to prop up teams that can't make it on their own. Dave Bortolazzo is a lifelong Maple Leafs fan. He says he thinks he knows why NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman seems bent on keeping teams in the Sun Belt.
That's because the little dictator doesn't want to admit that he's wrong. That's what it is right there. And he is American. That's what it is. He doesn't want to admit that he's made a mistake that by continuing to pump money into these teams and promote these teams rather than let them move to a Canadian market. He thinks the American is where it's at. It's not. You could probably survive three teams in this market. Two for sure. No problem.
It's not just fans and media who have deep concerns about the NHL's weaker markets. So too does the NHL Players Association and its leader, Paul Kelly. Kelly knows that all those empty seats in the Sun Belt mean less revenue for the players. He says the players are committed to helping keep the NHL's 30 teams in their existing markets, but he says if that's not viable, the best alternative is obvious.
If they can't and one of them has to be moved, we think that the league must look first to Canada. I mean, I think that the history here, particularly the recent history since the lockout, shows that the six Canadian franchises are doing extraordinarily well. I mean, they're selling out their buildings night after night. They're doing very well in terms of their secondary sales of merchandise and concessions. They have reasonably high ticket prices and lots of enthusiasm by the Canadian public. There are a number of cities across Canada that we believe would accommodate a team. We think that Toronto, Southern Ontario could certainly accommodate a second team. We believe that places like Winnipeg, Quebec City, there are a number of other cities, obviously, in the United States that have expressed interest, but I think Canada should be at the top of the list.
Like all of the sports world, the NHL is bracing for the full effect of the current economic downturn. Sports fans are being forced to make tough choices, and some wonder whether that could force the NHL to return a team or two to the place where hockey's popularity never wavers, good times or bad. For Only a Game, I'm Dave Naylor in Toronto.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. We did it! Long live Mexico! Thus spoke Mexican singer and actress Susana Zavaleta after she'd learned that the crowd in Mexico City's main square, the Zocalo, had set a new record for number of folks simultaneously engaged in kissing. Organizers said the Valentine's Day kiss-in was meant to celebrate the warmth and love at the heart of the Mexican Republic. We love demonstrating our love in front of everyone, said Lucia Gutierrez, one of the 39,897 kissers participating in the event. It would have been 39,898 people, except that Benito Zavala didn't have time to go home and get his wife, and so he kissed his dog.
Kiss me, and when you do, I know that you will miss me, if we ever say adieu, so kiss me, make me...
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, walking Ireland's golf courses and walking between them as well. But first, in one respect, at the top of the women's basketball rankings, nothing has changed since the University of Connecticut won their first exhibition game by 51 points. They won their second exhibition game by 66. UConn not only has yet to lose, as far as I can tell, they have yet to be seriously challenged. Joining me now to either support or debunk that observation is Michelle Smith, who writes about women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me. It's pretty hard to debunk at this point.
Yeah, 26-0, 12-0 in the Big East. Notre Dame, number 24 in the country, is supposed to play Connecticut tomorrow. Should the Fighting Irish just claim the flight was canceled?
Oh, you know, it's just, I mean, the teams that Louisville's gone in and lost handily, I mean, they're just, Connecticut's really just rolling over people, and it looks, you know, like this whole season, the way Connecticut's playing has looked a little like an exercise in inevitability, but, you know, it's hard to know. You get into the tournament, you get a matchup, or you put a team in a position where they've had so much success. You know, there are those coaches who believe there are lessons to be learned in losing, and Connecticut hasn't had any of those lessons this year.
No, rolling over is the right term. The scores by which Connecticut has won, 107-53, 106-78, 109-51, and as you say, they beat Louisville, number 8 team in the country, 93-65. I guess it has been as easy as the numbers have made it look.
Yeah, they haven't been tested really all year. They've just, you know, they've really just dominated every team that they've played. They're very, very good, obviously. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting tournament because I think that a lot of people think they're playing for second place. You know, they'll get to the Final Four and, you know, Connecticut will, you know, get its crown and everybody else will be happy to be there. I don't know. It's strange because what's happening in the rankings below that appears to be, for lack of a better term, a crapshoot. I mean, there are, you know, it's Connecticut and a lot of other teams in the mix.
Well, let's talk about some of those other teams. Oklahoma, the number 2 team in the country, has only lost twice this season, once to UConn. When Oklahoma beat Texas Tech on Tuesday night, Courtney Paris had more than 20 points and more than 20 rebounds for the 11th time in her career. So this would appear to be a team that could play for a championship, especially if Oklahoma knocks off number 5 Baylor this afternoon.
Yeah, Oklahoma's a very good team, and it's, you know, and they're playing really, really well. And both of the Paris twins, Courtney and her sister Ashley, are having really, really good seasons, and they're very motivated. That program has not done as much as they had hoped with those girls on the roster. You know, they've gotten booted out in the second round in the Sweet 16. They want to go a long way, and they're playing like they do. And they've got good guard play, which is not something they've had necessarily the past few years to complement the Paris twins. I mean, they've got everything. But again, you know, Connecticut beat them handily, too. So it's, you know, it's an interesting place to be. But I think Oklahoma is definitely looking like a Final Four team at this point.
Number 7 Duke overmatched Virginia Tech by 16 points on Thursday night. 3 nights earlier, Duke beat Tennessee 62-54. In another season, beating the Vols would have been a very big deal. This winter, not so much, as Tennessee has continued to struggle. How long is that likely to be the case?
The Vols are very young and struggling a lot. And Pat, you know, has talked all season about losing her patience. And if she's lost it as many times as she said she has, then it's long gone. But I thought this would be a Final Four team because how do you just not pencil Pat in there? But I'm not sure now. I don't think that this team is good enough right now.
Maryland was the team that handed Rutgers their 10th loss on Sunday. Then on Thursday, the Terps beat Georgia Tech. Not so very long ago, only 3 years ago. In fact, Maryland won the championship. If they can get by Duke tomorrow, is Maryland going to look like a team peaking at the right time?
Yeah, I think so. I think Maryland also had a couple of bumps early in the season, but they look really good right now. And they've got Christy Tolliver's one of the best point guards in the country, and they've got Marissa Coleman. They have a nice team, and those players have been on that national championship team. They were young players when it happened, but that Maryland's a good team, and I think they're rallying right now.
I sense that you're getting restless about the fact that I've mentioned no team west of Oklahoma. Stanford, which beat Oregon State by 29 on Thursday night, has lost only 4 times this season, once in overtime, once by 3 points, once by 2 points. They did get blown out once by Baylor in November. How significant is Stanford's most recent winning streak?
You know, they're playing really well right now, and I have to say the Pac-10's not very good. Cal is a very good team, and those games against Cal, the 3-point loss in Berkeley and then the win over Cal, were big wins for Stanford. They haven't played a really good team in a fair amount of time. Arizona State is a good team out in the Pac-10. They're kind of lurking back there in the standings, but Stanford is rolling over most of the bad teams in the Pac-10 pretty easily. That being said, Cal is also a very good team, and Ashley Walker is having a great season. So the end of the Pac-10 season is going to be kind of a horse race between Stanford and Cal, but, you know, we've got two top 10 teams out here from the same conference and a lot of other people on the outside looking in the Pac-10, I will tell you that.
The most discouraging Division I stat this season comes from Indiana State, where four players have gone down with ACL injuries. Any progress across the board at learning how to prevent knee blowouts in women's basketball?
Honestly, apparently not. Stanford had another one. They had a reserve player have an ACL injury in practice on Wednesday, and she's done for the year. It's just something that happens so frequently, and the teams are working so hard on prevention, and those two things haven't come together yet.
Okay, Michelle, time for you to give us your final four, or maybe I should just say the terrific three who are likely to join Connecticut in St. Louis this time around.
All right, so we have Connecticut. We have, I'm going to say Oklahoma. I'm liking Maryland right now. And, you know, I'm going to go with Stanford because they were there. They were there last year, and they're big. They're big. Their starting lineup she's been running the last has a 6-foot point guard and goes up from there. So they're big.
Michelle Smith writes about women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle, and those comments notwithstanding, she is not on the payroll at Stanford. She does join me for the discussion of women's basketball from time to time at Only a Game. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Everybody knows that Ireland is green and has lots of golf courses. Very few people have set out to play all those courses. But wait, there's more. In order to write his most recent book, A Course Called Ireland, Tom Coyne not only played almost 60 courses, for the most part, he walked between them. Tom Coyne joins me now from WHYY in Philadelphia. Tom, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me back.
You acknowledge at the outset that you weren't entirely convinced that walking around all of Ireland to play every links course the country offered would be a good idea. What did you imagine the risks might be?
Well, yeah, there were a lot of question marks about doing this kind of trip, most of them coming from my wife, obviously. you know, there were a lot of concerns health-wise, weather-wise, and physically. You know, would I be able to – could you actually do it? But, I mean, I think initially – the challenge was sort of attractive. And I wanted to also do a story about Ireland. And as I sort of printed out a map of Ireland and sort of looked at where all the courses were, I mean, it really sort of suggests a golf course. I mean, the coastline is dotted with these links courses. You know, you can't go 10 miles without tripping over one. So it suggested to me, you know, the idea of playing Ireland is one big, great golf course.
Over 1,000 miles in total. You walked over 1,000 miles to get to these courses.
Yeah, well, that included the golf itself. You know, if you would say the course was 1,100 miles or something. So when you play in links, you walk about 5 to 6 miles. But, you know, on any given day, I'd walk 14, 15, upwards of 22 miles between the towns. So some days, some weeks, it would be 5 days of just walking to get to the next course. But when it was sort of golf busy on the map, you know, we were playing every day or every other day.
Before we go any further, though, Tom, perhaps you should explain the difference between a links course, which is the sort of course the Irish coast features, and the golf courses with which people who play in this country are much more likely to be familiar.
Lynx golf grew up, you played in the dunes. You know, when the game started, you either 15, 1600s, you either used the land to farm on or it was the beach. And that land in between is where people would play their games or hunt or whatever. So that's where the shepherds started knocking a pebble around a field, and where they made their paths were the fairways, and the Rabin Warrens became the greens. And sort of, so there's really something sort of pure and attractive about that. You know, golf sort of built by nature and by wind and by sand. And that's why Ireland is so interesting, because it has 40% of the true links golf courses in the world. There are zero in America. Mm. By the strictest definition, there aren't any true links courses. So, you know, that's why people are getting on those planes every year with their golf clubs and trying to figure it out.
Well, you had to learn to deal with a lot of obstacles as you pursued your goal of playing every genuine Lynx course in Ireland. And one of the obstacles was the so-called full Irish. Tell us of its perils.
My nemesis. It was funny. The first week we get there, and I'm with my best man, Joe Byrne, and the first morning we run down for our full Irish. And the full Irish would be, you know, it's full in every conceivable way. You've got the fried eggs. You've got Irish rashers, which is, you know, Irish bacon, but it's really more like a sort of a T-bone steak. sausage and blood pudding and the coffee, the blackest of black coffee, and the toast, and just course after course of these wonderful, you know, fried tomatoes and mushrooms. Really great for the first week. But when you're going to be in Ireland for 4 months and every morning you're going to be confronted in a bed and breakfast by a lovely little old lady who thinks that she makes the best full Irish in the country, and then it's her responsibility to prove that fact and, you know, defend her county's reputation. Every morning it was sort of a nightmare that I would relive. You know, how do I go in and tell her that I just want cereal?
Well, we haven't got time to discuss all or even many of the courses you played, but I would like to hear about the one that you labeled, and I'm quoting now, the most dangerous golf course on the planet.
Well, there was a nine-holer. And nine-holers in America are sort of, you know, the lesser cousin of miniature golf. You know, they're sort of pitch and putts and sort of maligned as not worthy of your time. Ireland has a great nine-hole tradition. Old courses squeezed into small pieces of property. And this course in Buncrana that I came across by accident, as I came across most of these courses, there was actually, you know, they stuffed nine holes into like a soccer field. And there was a hole that there was a tee box on each end and a green on each end, but one fairway in the middle. So you actually and it was a par four. So you were teeing off at each other. I mean, there were eight guys standing in the fairway hitting their second shots as people are hitting at them from both directions. I mean, it was a great crossfire. I mean, I know I had three balls that day put in the pocket of people passing by. I almost got killed. It was, but you know, that's the kind of stuff. I mean, people ask, you know, where should I go play? I get a lot of questions about, you know, how should I design my trip? And I tell them to go to places like that because to me, I mean, that's. You know, part of the fun, you know, it's something different, something you're not going to get in your, you know, your typical trip.
Were you surprised to learn as you walked from course to course that you had become something of a celebrity in Ireland?
As I was doing it, or, you know, hear from people now, you know, why didn't you just get in a car? And I think one of the reasons I didn't expect that really was keeping me on the road was the fact that I sort of became a little bit of this sort of Irish golfing Forrest Gump. Like, people, I'd go into these towns, and because my story was being covered in the papers over there, and I did some radio too. And it's, you know, it's a small country and a very conversational country. Everyone sort of knows everything that's going on. So I'd walk into a town, or people would stop on the road in the middle of nowhere and wish me luck, or say hello, or call me by my name. It was wild. You know, I was really thankful that I did choose to walk for this trip. You know, not just because of that, but I had so many more conversations because of that. When I stopped in the pub and the guy next to me knew who I was, you know, we could have an hour-long chat and he'd buy me a couple pints, which is nice. But by being the guy, the crazy American who's walking around Ireland, I could strike up a conversation pretty much with anyone. And it was a great way to sort of just to get people to talk to you. And that, I think, you know, really informs and helps the story in the end.
They could all tell who you were as you walked down the road, obviously, because besides carrying a pack, a stripped-down pack of the essentials, you were carrying golf clubs.
I was. Yeah, there was no doubt that it was me. Backpack, a little sort of almost like a quiver with, well, we started out with 11 clubs, nine clubs by the second day. I think I finished with six. I was just dispatching them on the side of the road. I mean, I know I left a wedge on the road to Lahinch. I mean, my stuff is just sort of scattered around the coast of Ireland, as you know, to lighten the load. Yeah, so I had a sort of quiver of clubs strapped up to this pack. Yeah, so you knew it was me, dressed in my waterproofs, looking usually pretty miserable. It did rain 38 days in a row, so there was some misery involved, but.
I'm speaking with Tom Coyne, author of A Course Called Ireland, and you're listening to Only a Game. You write that what you came to love about Ireland was, quote, the place had imagination unchecked. It's a wonderful phrase. To what extent was that a realization regarding the golf?
Yeah, it was about the golf. It was about the people. It was about the stories. It was about the music. These courses that I'm playing, they were built by wind and nature and blown sand. And that definitely helped create this sort of effect of this imagination of the place. I think I was having that realization as I was in a pub in the afternoon listening to a young girl that worked at the bar singing some very old Irish songs to just a group of a few guys. And I was sort of just eavesdropping on the whole thing. And no one was sort of cracking jokes about it. No one was feeling silly. You're allowed to sort of be sentimental. Mm. You're allowed to believe in a story. And that's why I think in this one sense that the Irish are such great storytellers. I think it's something that at the core of being Irish is sort of what's kept them going through all this stuff. That there's always this, there's always a third act, you know, and whether it's their religious stories, which have sustained the Irish, whether it's the stories about the Widow Murphy, whether it's a joke, whether it's a song, there's something so fundamental about the storytelling that as a writer, I just enjoyed being around to just soak it all up and try and collect as much of it as I could and pass it off as my own, you know. So.
Which is, after all, what we do, isn't it?
It sure is.
At the end of your trip through Ireland, you gave away what golf clubs remained. Have you acquired a new set since then?
I have. It was a little while, though. I probably went, when I came back, well, I had to write the book, so I wasn't playing a lot of golf. It was probably a year before I had sticks again. And I think the golf that I learned to play over there is really, I think it's made me a better player. And it's made me certainly enjoy the game quite a bit more. Playing, you know, when you're playing in the elements and playing sort of rough natural courses, you become a lot less concerned about hitting the perfect shot or looking good or what your score is. It's just, you're sort of just rolling your ball along the ground and trying to get it in the hole as fast as you can. And that's what golf over there was about. And I've translated a little bit of that mentality to my game here. And I'm actually, when I do get to play, I'm enjoying it a lot, probably a lot more than I ever have.
Tom Coyne is the author of A Course Called Ireland, A Long Walk in Search of a Country, A Pint, and the Next Tea, published by Gotham Books. He joined me from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks so much.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There are heists, and there are heists. And then there is the theft of approximately 150 bowling balls. Said bowling balls disappeared from Thurston's Restaurant and Bowling Alley in Frankfort, New York, sometime before last Friday night. Alicia Gatto, the owner of the establishment, said all the bowling balls were present and accounted for a week earlier when someone had most recently gone a-kegling, but now they're all gone. Or almost all of them. There's one left in the front, but the rest are all gone, Ms. Gatto said, adding, I'm lost.
Let's go bowling. Let's go bowling. Got a coupon. Let's go bowling. From a juice can. Let's go bowling. Let's go bowling. Let's go bowling. Let's do it now.
Yes, bowling. The sport of kings, the sport of queens, the sport of dukes.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game of You from the top of New York City, earned the hard way. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce. He's on the phone from Mississippi this week. Hello, Charlie.
Checking in on our new listeners in Oxford, Bill.
Excellent. And I hope they're all well, and I certainly hope they're all listening. I'm sad to report that despite working their dialing fingers to the bone, the Phoenix Suns and the Cleveland Cavaliers ran out of time before they could trade Shaquille O'Neal to Cleveland ahead of the NBA's trading deadline on Thursday. Are you sad that the big Aristotle will not get a chance to play alongside King James?
Well, it would have been an amusing half season for sure, but his contract is simply unloadable, especially if Cleveland is gearing up to try to keep LeBron James, which they probably aren't. But it's understandable from Cleveland's point of view because they really are looking at losing James probably in a couple of years, and they have one run at this. But I was a little bit surprised that all the T's couldn't get crossed.
Greg Oden missed his entire first season as a pro due to a knee injury. He missed the first six games of this season with a foot injury, and then he had to sit out Wednesday night's game due to a bone chip in the other knee, the one that had been okay. Have we reached the point where even the Trailblazers' opponents are rooting for this guy to stay healthy?
Yeah, this is a sad tale, actually, because he really is a terrific player and, by all accounts, a terrific person, and there's just... You know, he's just one of these snake-bit guys, and Portland put a lot on him. And right now it looks like they put a lot on somebody who was really damaged goods. But, of course, you know, the great story in Boston was always, well, we didn't take Greg Oden because we didn't get a chance to have him in the lottery. Aren't we lucky? Well, not so fast, because the more significant injury happened with Kevin Garnett going out against Utah on Thursday night.
Here's a game that I wish I had seen this week, Charlie. Milwaukee Madison High School basketball player Jontel Franklin decided that he would like to join his teammates on the court on the day that his mother passed away. She died of cancer. But his name was not in the scorebook, so Madison's opponent, DeKalb High, was awarded two free throws, a technical, before the game began. When a player named Darius McNeil volunteered to take those shots, his coach told him, "You realize you're going to miss, right?"
Yeah, it was a nice story all the way around. Of course, there are nothing but nice stories in Milwaukee, as I know from my 5 years there. And thus far, we have been spared, you know, talk show tough guy rhetoric about the sanctity of the game.
Oh, I hope so.
Which I would almost guarantee you that somewhere out there, some underrated and unnecessary evening drive guy is thinking it, but hasn't said it yet.
Meanwhile, Major League Baseball wants A-Rod to talk. I don't understand this. Wasn't it enough to hear him say at this week's press conference, "I laid my bed, I'm going to have to sit on it"?
To say nothing, he has to sit there and take his medicine. No, stop. That's what got you in the problem in the first place. Yeah, there's more details coming out, though. According to reports in the New York Daily News, he was regularly seen in the company of this guy named Presnell, who has been banned from all major league clubhouses for being essentially a steroid mule. So, no, I don't think this story's going away at all.
John Henry, the owner of the Boston Red Sox, has called for, quote, an enlightened salary cap in Major League Baseball. I've heard of enlightened slumlords. I'm not sure about enlightened salary cap. Is this a guy with one eye on the Yankees and the other on his previously successful huge hedge fund business?
Yeah, this is a guy who pretty plainly doesn't know what he's talking about. The players are not going to agree to a salary cap. It's not going to happen. They're not going to believe any books you show them that proves you need one. And I don't know what an enlightened salary cap is. I don't have the faintest bloody idea, and I don't think he does either.
This week, the Seattle Mariners reacquired 39-year-old Ken Griffey Jr., who played his first 11 seasons in Seattle with the Mariners. If this works, and, you know, he does a good job for them, who do they sign next? Jim Boughton? He played in Seattle.
No, I think they should bring back one of their most famous young guys and bring A-Rod back to Seattle.
He might come cheap the way things are going. Elsewhere in baseball acquisitions, the Washington Nationals are trying to figure out how a 23-year-old named Carlos Alvarez posed as a 19-year-old named Esmalin Gonzalez and secured the largest international signing bonus in team history. Mr. Alvarez has now acquired a passport under his real name, and he intends to show up for spring training. And I can't imagine that he'll be very welcome in Florida. What do you think?
Well, I think the first thing that the Washington Nationals ought to do is figure out how they hired most of the people in their international scouting department. And the real question, of course, is where did the money go? Because apparently it disappeared. And I suspect that once he arrives, the most interesting rookie in anyone's spring camp is going to have an interesting conversation, not only with officials of the Nationals, but with officials of perhaps the national law enforcement apparatus.
In off-season football news this week, Shane Lechler of the Oakland Raiders became the highest-paid player whose specialty is such that anybody knocking him down gets penalized. The Raiders will pay him in excess of $3 million a season. Good investment for a punter?
Well, I mean, this is a franchise that has, you know, a proud tradition of great punters. Ray Guy, perhaps the greatest punter of all time, played for the Raiders. It seems to me, you know, on the surface to be another masterpiece of Raider mismanagement, though.
Meanwhile, the Raiders have reached an agreement with Nnamdi Asomugha, making him the highest-paid defensive back in National Football League history. I guess there's no recession in Oakland.
No, this is an interesting move for the Raiders, who just barely hired a coach. I mean, once again, it's hard to predict anything Al Davis will do, but apparently he's printing money in his basement now.
This week's women's pro tennis tournament in Dubai will be without Shahir Peer, an Israeli player. She was denied a visa by the United Arab Emirates, allegedly for her own safety. The Tennis Channel didn't buy that explanation. They're not going to put the tournament on TV, and I guess the players don't buy it either.
Well, some of the players aren't. They're searching old suitcases to find out where they've been storing their vestigial consciences over the year. But good on the Tennis Channel. I may find myself obligated to watch whatever they show instead.
Okay, riddle time. How might it happen that somebody characterized by the police in Sacramento as a person who did the right thing might eventually be recharacterized as, quote, a person of interest?
Yeah, it was put out on the street that people should bring Lance Armstrong's bike back. No questions asked. Guess what? Some questions are going to be asked.
How'd you find that bike?
Yeah, like, where did you get the bike
from?
That's
the first question.
More to the point, where did you get the stolen bike from?
And finally, Charlie, the Amateur Boxing Association recently turned down the application for a boxing license for Sarah Bluden of Dorset, England. They said her breast implants could be damaged in the ring. Since when do boxing commissions worry about preserving the cosmetic charms of boxers?
What can I tell you, Bill? The fight against performance enhancement goes on.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time to wrestle with questions like that one. Thank you, Charlie.
Just keeping abreast of the news.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear our program and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, and you can visit our website, onlyagame.org. Getting to the top of the Empire State Building is easy. Wait in line, buy a ticket, step into the elevator, and less than 60 ear-popping seconds later, you're on the 86th floor observation deck. But every year, hundreds of athletes decide to take in the views the hard way. Only a Game's Karen Given was on the scene earlier this month as runners laced up their shoes for the 32nd annual Empire State Building Run-Up. And she has our story.
G-U-E.
G-U-E. First name?
Zala.
T-shirts and pins are right over there.
While most Manhattanites arrive at work in the gray and black of Tuesday morning business attire, roughly 300 brightly clothed athletes cram into a newly remodeled conference room on the second floor of the Empire State Building. They pick up their timing chips, grab race T-shirts, and stretch. Except for Linda Hubbard. She's taking a picture of her shoe.
Yeah, I wanted to see what my shoe looked like before and after.
Is it dirty in there?
No, it's not too dirty.
No, it's just dry.
Hubbard and her friend Jody Gravino met at the Empire State Building run-up 3 years ago. They've both finished this race 4 times already, so they know to enjoy a bit of socializing before the solitude of the stairwell. This is a race with no spectators, no majestic sights along the way, and only fellow competitors for company for 86 lonely flights.
You can hear everybody else. You can hear everybody breathing and you know, sighing and pain
And it doesn't last too long. It's over before you know it, thank God.
The men's champion will finish in just over 10 minutes, and the women's champion will take about 3.5 minutes more. Linda Hubbard didn't do her usual pre-race training of stair climbers and stairwells, but she still thinks she has this race under control.
Being mentally prepared is probably most important. And I woke up this morning and said, okay, you know, I could do it. I'm in the shower saying, I can do this, I can do it, I can do it. I'm going to do it.
Andreas Straisman looks like he can do it if he doesn't run out of energy before he hits the first stair. He's warming up, bouncing and hopping and running in place. Later today, he'll drive to Connecticut to his job as an architect. But for now, his focus is on this 77-year-old building on Fifth Avenue.
It's actually exciting to run the Empire State Building. It's such an important building in New York. I'm from Germany, and I always admired, you know, the graciousness of the building. And being an architect, obviously, you know, it's wonderful to, you know, one of the wonders of the world, as I would call it.
As a second-time runner of this race, Straisman knows that there are no wonders awaiting him in the stairwell.
No, it's mostly gray and long and never-ending.
Jeanette Bedard isn't worried about the view on the way up. She's just looking forward to breaking out onto the observation deck.
You feel like you are in the clouds. In the clouds, in orbit. Beautiful. I hope God permits me a few more years. One never knows. Nothing lasts forever. Nothing.
At 75, Bedard is this year's oldest runner, but she's definitely well prepared.
I run every day. 3 hours every day.
3 hours every day?
Yeah. It's not a race. If I do less, I feel guilty.
Now, today, it won't be 3 hours, but will this count? You won't go running after this, will you?
No. I ran this morning a little bit, just a little bit, to keep my heart going, you know?
Merci.
Bedard can find a fellow Francophile or two in the crowd. The runners come from 14 countries and 23 states. Dwayne Fernandez has made the longest trip from Sydney, Australia. The first thing I notice about Fernandez is his bright smile and thick Aussie accent. It takes longer to notice his main claim to fame.
I'm the first person with two false legs to run up the Empire State Building.
Fernandez learned how to train for stair climbing when he was the first double amputee to finish the Sydney Tower climb last year. Fernandez had only a week to train for the Sydney race's 1,501 steps, but he trained a little harder for the Empire State Building's 1,576.
Stairs, lots of stairs. I have access to the fire stairs at work, so every second lunchtime, not every lunchtime, I'm not that fit, run up from the bottom all the way to the top, and repeat. So I'm reasonably fit. I'm quite sure I'll make it on top.
And do you have a goal? Just make it to the top, any speed? Or
make it to the top, keep a pace, and once I'm at the top, it's a world record. I'm quite happy for people to come and break my record, but I'm still the world first.
Are you ready to run up today?
About 70 women are lined up at the start line in a broad hallway on the first floor. The race goes off in three different heats because the stairwell can't accommodate everyone at once. So it's first the ladies, then the top group of men 5 minutes later, and the final group of men 5 minutes after that. Still, there's a lot of jostling on the start.
Ladies, take your mark.
The horn blows, and two-time defending champion Susie Walsham looks to be the first to the stairs. But at the last minute, she's bumped and runs face-first into the marble wall. About 20 women rush past before a few of the runners pick Walsham up and push her into the stairwell. For the next 13 minutes, they can hear her crying in pain, but she does not give up.
Two turns to the right, you're finished. Come on, push hard.
The runners emerge from the dry stairwell to light snow on the observation deck. Amazingly, Walsham appears first, still sobbing. The scene is more cheerful as three-time defending champion Thomas Dold crosses the tape more than 20 seconds ahead of his nearest competitor. He's exhausted but happy and makes a show of collapsing on the ground, arms outstretched, where he's almost run over by the second-place finisher, Marco De Gasperi of Italy.
Brava, Cristina!
In all, 285 runners finished the race this year. Double amputee Dwayne Fernandez was among the slower runners at 26 minutes 12 seconds. But in a conference room on the 80th floor, he's still jumping for joy at his new world record. Thomas Dold of Germany missed the world record by just over 30 seconds, but he's still surrounded by German media at the awards ceremony. Thomas Dold has won tower races in Berlin and Munich, as well as Vienna, Milan, Taipei, and Singapore. According to his personal website, his tower running exploits are featured in the German edition of Playboy magazine. At home, he's a bit of a celebrity, especially during his twice-weekly five-hour round-trip train ride to the nearest tall buildings in Frankfurt.
The guy asked me, hey, what's with you? You're sweating and you're looking really tired. What have you done? So I think, yeah, I was in Frankfurt for training. Or what do you train in Frankfurt? I'd practice tower running. Oh, I know the race in the Empire State Building. Do you know it also? Yeah, I won it three times, four times now.
While Dold has participated in tower races all over the world, John Korf, a New Yorker who's just completed his 8th Empire State Building run-up, knows where the real glory is.
Oh, yeah, this is like the Wimbledon of stair racing. This is where it's at. If you're a thoroughbred, you want to be at the Kentucky Derby. If you're a NASCAR racer, you want to be at Indianapolis. If you're a stair racer, you want to be at the Empire State Building.
And are you a stair racer?
Well, sort of. I got from the bottom to the top, so that's the good news.
Korf jokes that the Empire State Building run-up is just like a 100-mile ultramarathon, except it's shorter. And like many of the day's runners, he's about to head to work, in his case, organizing the New York City Triathlon.
Yeah, well, what else am I going to do? Like, go celebrate? Am I going to go have martinis at 11:30 in the morning? No, you slink into work and you do like that, and then you sit at your desk and you work all day, and when you're done, you stand up and your back is stiff. And you call your wife and you get yelled at and you go home to your 3 kids. Just like another day.
Just like another day. Except today is the day that he climbed 86 flights of stairs to the top of New York City. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Giffen.
It's a long, hard climb, but I'm gonna get there. It's a long, hard climb, but I'm gonna get there. It's a long, hard climb, but I'm gonna get there.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Brian Fadham and from Al Banks at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallace. If you'd like to see photos of the Empire State Building run-up, download our weekly podcast or read my blog. Really, I'm a blogger now. Old dog, new trick. Please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. In our final words, stair runner and ultramarathoner John Korf answers an essential question. What's harder, climbing 86 flights or running 100 miles?
100 miles. After 10 minutes of this, you're done. After 10 minutes of that, you're still tying your shoes.
Essential question or silly question? You decide. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
I'm climbing to the morning sun. I'm climbing to the morning sun.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.